For Rachel, paper white origami dove of light, fantastic, sarcastic lover of life, you stood your ground to protect justice. You are gone and I am breathless. Your bravery makes me believe in lions again, although I've never seen one free. I miss you, how can it be? You are with me, always up to something, cracking smiles and schemes to repaint the world. Your courage engraved in my consciousness, a paper white origami dove, a flash of light. You burst into flames, an incandescent flare illuminating heaven. Baby girl, woman, goddess, may you travel through cool air to ash and solace and peace.
Thank you.
Hello, I'm Shirley Scott. I'm the Crisis Services Manager for Behavioral Health Resources. Rachel worked for Behavioral Health Resources Hospital Diversion House for over 3 years. And in this capacity, Rachel worked with a chronically mental ill population that was in crisis. Many of these people were at acute risk for being hospitalized in psychiatric units. She came to HDH with very little knowledge or experience of the mental health field, but she was like an enthusiastic sponge, always eager to learn more, always wanting to know how to improve her skills. We did many supervision sessions where she would want to know how to approach a client differently, how to improve the way she was working with her group. She worked well in the multitasking environment of HDH. Things are happening very fast. Lots of people in crisis, lots of different types of crises. And she was able to be a calm personality there. And she said that she was ADD. She said that the more things that were happening, the more fun she would have. She wouldn't get bored in her job. And you could see that because she never got bored. She always was enthusiastic about getting the work done. She encouraged the clients to access their own inner strengths and inner resources, and therefore develop more coping skills, be able to deal with their problems, and then also seek out staff support. This approach of hers made a big difference for those clients. It helped them turn and find their own strength versus always just running and asking someone else for help. She showed respect to myself and her peers and the clients, always respected the clients. She earned the respect of myself and her coworkers and the clients. She earned Employee of the Quarter as elected by her peers for many different reasons. But it was a unanimous vote. She contributed ideas to the overall improvement of the program and the quality of services that BHR provided to their clients in crisis. She was respectful of the cultural differences of the people that came in and the diversity of the staff that were providing services. During her time at BHR, Rachel demonstrated advocacy skills towards the clients. She went to our foundation and the board and requested funds for the drop-in group, requested funds for arts and crafts supplies that we didn't have. She was always going to get another project going to serve these people. She got the foundation board to donate a van to take them on some trips, and some trips went. Just always had a lot of energy to give to the clients. During her time there, she helped develop a drop-in group, and that was an aftercare group to help clients who needed to further stabilize. Many times these clients were folks that tended to isolate in their homes, not talk or communicate with other people due to voices or depression. One of these, she had many success stories out of this group. One of the clients from this group has given his permission to share, has given me permission to share his story. He was very clinically depressed and tended to isolate for more than a month in his home. He would not talk or communicate with anyone and many times would end up in a psychiatric unit. And he would cycle through this process. When he became a member of Rachel's group, he slowly started coming to group, wanting to be there, but being torn and wanting to be isolating again. He reports that he couldn't talk many times when he'd come to group because he had become mute. And the depression was overwhelming. He said that Rachel's calming, open presence for him was enough that through the process of her three-hour group, he would be able to, at the end, pass notes and sometimes even talk. This made a major difference in this man's life. Rachel made a major difference in many clients' lives that we serve. And a colleague and I was sharing a story of a client who became catatonic during her group one day, and how she was able to hold herself together during that process of getting the ambulance crew there, getting the support of the other crisis services staff, getting the client's needs met. And then afterwards, after the whole chaos had ended, she came in and had a good cry and spent some time processing that in a healthy way. She had an open and respectful manner. It soothes people in crisis. Her total motivation and dedication to her work at HDH and with this drop-in group to the mental health population that this community serves made a major difference to those people. The success of our team at HDH was in great deal due to the dedication of Rachel. From the staff at HDH and myself, we would like the family to know that we will be keeping you in our thoughts and prayers.
This is KAOS 89.3 FM Olympia.
It is so good to see so many people who loved Rachel and who Rachel loved here in one place right now. And I just want to introduce myself. My name is Colin Reese, and I was together off and on with Rachel for the last 4.5 years or so. And I want to introduce my new friend Stefan from Sweden, who was Rachel's new boyfriend, and he met her in Rafa. And he has been sitting with me over there holding my hand, and he's my new friend too. And I've seen so many other people up here with large groups of people behind them. I didn't want to come up here alone. And I would also like to ask my parents if they would please come up and stand behind me, because this is going to be very, very emotional for me. Like so many of you, I loved Rachel very, very much. And what I want to talk about, so many people, and for representing so many different parts of her life today, have shared their experiences with her. And I was very privileged to get to see Rachel as her spirit, like as pure as I think she ever was. And I got to know intimately her process and how she connected the various parts of her community and balanced everything to make a complete person. And I want to share some of that with you and some of her own words about it too. But one thing that she never liked at all was when people idealized her, when people made her out to be something she wasn't. And lest I be accused of doing that by her now, I just want to say right off the bat that she was the messiest girl that I have ever known. She never did her dishes. And
Though her ability to organize people and events and protests and so many things was so strong, you did not want to see her closet, ever. thank you so much for coming up here. When I first met Rachel in 1998, she was heavily under the influence of Paul Gauguin. And this is important because Rachel had such a vibrant inner life, so connected. We've seen a little bit of how Rachel was so connected with her poetry and her art, and she was very, very influenced by creative minds around her. And for that reason, I think mostly because she was continuously engaged with her imagination, she had an inner life going on, and her world perhaps made sense only to her, but it's probably that quality of hers, her inner self and her creativity, that ultimately was why we spent so much time together. And I'll explain some of that. Shortly after I met her, Rachel told me that she had had several dreams about me before we had met, and I think this impressed her, because she was the kind of person who listened to her dreams. She felt a very strong connection with her subconscious, and it had to have been something like that, because at the time I was anything but a catch, you know? I was extremely confused and lost back then, and I think she was a little confused and lost too, and that's why we started dating. As I said, Rachel was heavily under the influence of Paul Gauguin, but I didn't realize this. And Rachel, I think, had found a companion in him. His bright colors, his compassion, the way he rendered people, so sympathetic. These things struck home with her, and I think also she was enthralled by the idea of traveling to a remote island somewhere and creating something completely new. And I think that connection started a train of thought that would develop over the passing years. And this is what she spoke to me about as what she called imaginary Tahiti. And I knew nothing of this at the time. Sometime in the first few weeks of our relationship, we were talking in her little studio apartment on Adams Street, and it was as messy as anything I've ever seen. I don't recall the conversation, but I do remember that she was staring at me with her bright eyes, and it made me uncomfortable because she had such a penetrating, soulful way of looking at people. I hid my face in the crook of my elbow, and she wanted to know where I thought I was hiding. And for some reason, I said, Tahiti. And I think that's when Rachel opened up to me, because she took little things and coincidences that happened around her and turned them into signs, and felt strong connections she felt there was meaning in the everyday things that happen. And so at that point, our relationship really started to blossom, or started to get more intense anyway. And I can look back now, and I'm so glad I didn't say Galapagos or Cuba or any one of the 100 other islands, because I don't know where we would have been then. Some months later, Rachel wrote me a letter, and in the letter she said, Colin, there's a planet floating in a purple reality somewhere, and there's a Tahiti on the planet with fat versions of you and me playing on the beaches. We both wear muumuus all the time, or just hang out naked because we're too fat to wear anything else. And we play Scrabble and write haiku all night and sing to each other with congas and banjos and watch Dr. Strangelove again and again. And we drag each other out on the roof to watch the sunset, and we break the roof because we're too fat, and we fall through into our king-size bed. And over again, we fix the roof and fall through it again because we are so in love with the sunset and fixing roofs never phases us. And we catch fireflies and have babies and raise them as circus clowns. And I write you the longest love poem, and you cry. We both cry all the time over the taste of avocados and the sun setting in the ocean, over the parabolas of each other's cheekbones and eyebrows, over how lucky we are, over haiku. And we eat each other's tears and cry because they taste so good. And we never leave each other because nobody else anywhere can make us laugh so hard. Yes, I believe in that reality. I want to go to that Tahiti when I die. I think of it like this. Love is a function of community, and by community, I mean the interwoven lives of the people our love and kindness have touched. However big your community is, to that degree are you loved and capable of loving. And this is a cliche, but some cliches are offset for a reason. And I skipped a little. Somehow I deleted a paragraph in this reading, but I want to say it now. This paragraph, though it touched me so much at the time, this, in retrospect, was one of the darkest periods of Rachel in my life. It's sad to me now that her Tahiti had just two people in it, you know? I think when we started our relationship, our world shrank together, you know, and it was so intense but so unhealthy because we excluded so much of the community and so much that fed who Rachel was and her soul. And so, like I say, love is a function of the community, and love, like a fire, illuminates our lives. And in the time when Rachel's Tahiti had just two people in it, her life was like a vast dark space with only a single candle illuminating it. Over the years, my greatest privilege has been to see her life get brighter as her community has grown. That was Rachel, age 19, in one of many, many letters where she broke up with me. She broke up with me a lot. Rachel would have been really, really embarrassed to have that paragraph read, principally because she has grown so much since, and her love has become so great that it just doesn't compare to what it was like back then. In fact, her love has grown so big because there was so much to your life, Rachel, that there isn't time yet to recount every important detail. And in many ways, as I write this, I'm getting the feeling that I'm trying to learn lessons from you that I should have learned years ago. I think, though, that there is no reason to rush. I'll never stop trying to learn from you. You have taught me so much already, and I will try to stick to that. And while I was writing this, there was a protest going on across the street from the apartment that Rachel and I shared. And I heard police sirens, and I heard people shouting, and I heard megaphones. And while I was writing this, I couldn't shake the feeling that Rachel was saying to me, "What are you doing staying inside writing this about me? You need to be out there, you know." But I stayed inside because I felt like I needed to share this with the community. So I'll skip forward a few years, and I remember sometime last summer we were in this trying to save our relationship phase of the relationship. And we spent so many nights trying to save our relationship that ultimately we broke up because of trying to save our relationship. And that was a good thing, you know. It was a good thing because we became best friends, and that's how I will always remember Rachel. But at the time we were talking, and Rachel always used to be sad that I couldn't cry. You know, I was very reserved with my emotions when we would get in these discussions, and it had been so long that I had cried in front of her. I think I had forgotten how to. But that night, the thought of my best friend being away from me, we were talking about taking a year apart from each other so that we could develop our lives. And the idea of spending even a year without her made a single tear fall down my cheek. And like true to her nature, she had these threads in her imagination, and it was exactly the same as that letter that she wrote to me earlier. As soon as that tear showed up, she stuck out her finger and grabbed the tear and put it in her mouth, and she grabbed a journal that was lying right next to the bed, because there was hundreds of them scattered around the apartment, and she wrote down something like, "July 17th, 2002, Colin sheds a tear and Rachel promptly eats it." See, Rachel, you taught me so much about how to live. Forever, because of you, it will be okay for me to cry. I will picture you smiling and eating my tears. For me, you will be my friend who eats tears, the one who dries my eyes when I am finished being sad. And lest I be accused of idealizing you, you will be the messiest of all my angels. Sometimes I try and picture where you are and what you are doing now. It's beautiful, really. I see your imagination and your love slowly diffusing into the world. I see you as free. I see you return to the well of creativity from which you sprang. and I wonder what you'll become. You are so playful, Rachel. You taught me the value of found objects, and I found this slip of paper from you in one of the many things that was left in my apartment. And I think you must have subconsciously left it there to give me one more image of you to hold on to. I know people can't see, but in the corner there's a little brightly colored doodle that she was doodling continuously. And it reads, "This is what I look like when at night I turn into a tropical fish and swim in the coral. I look like an underwater comet, or maybe an ornate badminton birdie, or a soft chunk of animated abalone shell. I go out at dusk. I am so small and flexible, I can swim between the branches of the sea fans and not fracture even a twig. I see Rachel now being rocked gently back and forth by the current of the ocean in a forest of coral and sea life, finally experiencing something that she had missed while she had a body. A part of Rachel always wanted to be small, so small that she could pass through the world without being noticed. And yet, this is so different from the image people have of her now, Rachel the activist. And I think the difference is reconcilable. Rachel, though she yearned to be free and comforted by the beauty around her, nevertheless realized that as a person, she needed to work to help other people find the true freedom and beauty that she knew existed. I think she recognized that she had work to do. Rachel could never allow herself to drift off into comfort she knew was possible for her, because for her to do so while others suffered was reprehensible. And she learned over the course of her life that one of the most potent ways to affect change in society was through the power of community. I look out now at this gathering of people and I see many of those who made up Rachel's community. In this room are the people who shared their lives and love with her. And we can be proud because in many ways it was the strength of this community that created a person as wonderful and unique as Rachel. But Rachel's community has changed in the last few days. We have all watched the light of Rachel's life grow so much brighter by the countless people across the globe who now consider her family. Rachel's community has become global, and I am so happy for that because I believe that when a person dies, love for them is like a light welcoming them home. They are able to be anywhere someone that loved them is, and they are able to experience everything that someone who loved them has experienced. And I see Rachel so joyful at the infinite possibilities she has before her now. She spans the globe, and at the same time, she is a part of all of us. So I see her drifting back and forth through the reef of Tahiti, of her Tahiti. And on that island, I picture her with her entire community now, so much better than what she had picked for herself 5 years ago in her letter to me, because she's grown so much. Her entire community around her is on that island. I see her grandmother there. I see Craig and Cindy and Sarah and Kelly and Chris and Jasleen. I see Butch and Claudia and Bridget and Siri. I see her entire extended family. And I hear banjos and congas, and I hear the laughter coming from her island. I see all the food she likes spread around, and spread around everyone are her drawings and her poems, and everyone is so joyful. I see Kim and Christy and Josh and Todd, and I see Chad and Marie, and I see Larry and Therese and Lynn and Anne, and off into the distance there are countless people. I see the good doctor who held her as she died with her friends Will and Joe, and everyone else who worked with her in Rafa. I see the children who love her there, and I see all those who love her here. I see the Palestinians who consider her family, and I see the school children here who cried for her when they heard she wasn't coming back. I see her coworkers at HDH and all the drop-ins clients whose lives she touched and who touched her life. She loved you guys so much. No one on this island will ever have to repair anything twice because there are so many people to do the work for us. And everyone is completely unconcerned with names because they know that there is enough time on this Tahiti for them to get to know each person completely and to dance with everyone and eat everything again and again. And on this island, I see Rachel as she ties her hair back so she can eat more avocados and grow more fat and then dance with everyone again and again. And she is there with her new boyfriend, Stefan. And I am here with my new girlfriend, Michelle. And we all approve. I like him so much already. And from this world, from up here on this stage, As I look at this crowd, I can hear the music. It was like I was envisioning sort of a tropical kind of, like magnetic fields or something in the background. And I can watch that island with all of us celebrating her life and celebrating her, and she celebrating all of our lives because she would have done the same for us. I can watch that island from the stage slowly recede until I can barely hear the music anymore, and I can look out at all of us in this crowd, and I can ask why we don't spend the time we have together working to build the kind of world that Rachel would want for her Tahiti. And I hear Rachel whisper to me that the first step is to help people stop killing each other and destroying each other's houses. We have such a great opportunity here to build from this experience. And Rachel would laugh at us for talking so much about her when all she really wants us to do is just to comfort one another and help us through the hard time, and then educate ourselves and other people, organize and help people to stop killing and hurting other people. The end is pretty simple. Rachel, I miss you so, so much. And I know we all miss you. And we are lucky to have loved you and to have been loved by you. We have grown so much because we knew you. I love you, we love you, and we miss you. Thank you.
You're listening to Rachel Corey's Memorial Services live from the Evergreen State College here on KAOS 89.3 FM.
Stay with me, please. Thank you. Yes. That was very beautiful words. I'm Colin. And Rachel did warn me. She said that I shouldn't let her come to Sweden because she was very messy. But I said, it's okay, I can do the dishes. I came here to Olympia yesterday from Sweden. And I was in Rafah, Gaza Strip, Palestine, when Rachel came there, and we had around 3 weeks together before I had to leave her to return to Sweden for my job. But we stayed in almost daily contact through phone and text messages between our cellular phones and mail. And I received the last message from her the same day as the Israeli occupation force murdered her. I had tickets then in order to go to Rafah this Easter, 2 weeks, to visit her again. And this summer Rachel was coming to me in Sweden to live with me. Yesterday I spent all day with her parents and family. And I'm very happy because of that, and I want to thank you all for letting me in to share this grief with you. Thank you. They're all very wonderful people. They held me close and hard, took my hands in their own, and shared their feelings. And of course it's terrible for me to come here, because I shouldn't. I should have come here in August or something, after a couple of months together in Sweden, together with Rachel. Those were plants belonging to a distant historical period when she was alive. Now everything connected to her is down on its knees and crying. Every little plan, dream, love. But we can still live if we want to. We have that option. She has not. And if we do, I do think we should live with Rachel close in our minds. We should ask ourselves, is this something that Rachel would like us to do? And we all know that she would want us to work hard. She always did. We all know that she would like us to have fun, to enjoy ourselves in the middle of all the hardships of the world, because she always tried to stay happy, even in the middle of the war zone, or Rafah. We must all do different things, because we are all different. Rachel knew that. She wouldn't want people to do what they can't do. But she would demand of us all to do what we can to make this world a better place to live in for us all. And Rachel always thought especially of those who always tend to be the others. The children of the world, the women of the world, the oppressed, depressed, crazy, and non-conformative people of the world. The murder of Rachel made me feel that I didn't want to live anymore. I had enough. But then I thought of her dedication, and I felt that I have to stay here for her. The Israeli occupation force always tries to scare us when we work down there in Palestine. They try to make us leave Palestine so they can continue with their dirty work unattended. By killing Rachel, they did more than scare us. They did utterly hurt us all. Now we're so hurt that they can never scare us again. We're all Palestinians now. And we refuse to live on our knees. I'm going back to Palestine as soon as I can. I will continue Rachel's work. I hope we all will continue her work, all in our own way. For the world, for Rachel, älskar dig Rachel. Tack.
Hi. Yesterday, a friend and I ordered some takeout at the Mekong restaurant in downtown Olympia, and we received fortune cookies with our order. My friend's fortune read, "The weekend ahead predicts enjoyment." And my fortune said, "It is good to know that things are improving." And of course, we can't always trust fortune cookies. We have to make these fortunes come true. I often wonder what turns people to activism, and likewise, I wonder what turns people away from activism. And for many people out there, the problems of the world seem so big, insurmountable, and beyond reach. They just don't know what to do about it. For Rachel, Rachel's primary reason for traveling to Palestine was to forge a bond between the people of Palestine and the people of her hometown. She wasn't just interested in a short tour of the place. Inspired by the Thurston County Santo Tomas sister county relationship, in which our county shares bonds with Santo Tomas in Nicaragua, Rachel wanted to specifically foster a dialogue between Rafah and Olympia to bring the plight of Palestine home here, so people here could understand what was going on. When she arrived in Palestine, the Gaza Strip was undergoing the largest military attack since the start of the Intifada. It was a strategy of Ariel Sharon's re-election campaign. In Rafah, the Israeli military destroyed two of the city's three water wells. Rachel and her international colleagues informed the military that they would be guarding the only remaining water well in Rafah. Their presence was publicized within Israel, and it sparked a controversy that the military would do such a thing as destroy the water supplies. Already, Rachel and her friends were making headlines. Rachel and her team were also confronted with a massive bulldozing campaign, part of an Israeli strategy to clear entire neighborhoods and widen an Israeli security strip. Her team, the International Solidarity Movement of Rafah, intervened using classic techniques of nonviolent resistance. They physically blocked the bulldozers with their bodies, much like is currently performed by Rabbi Arik Asherman and Rabbis for Human Rights, as well as the Israeli Committee Against House Demolitions. But even between her nonviolent direct actions, Rachel found the time to connect with the Children's Parliament and to propose a pen pal project between Rafah and Olympia. She had already secured pen pal letters from Lincoln Elementary before she went to Palestine. She was also engaged in other activities to lay the groundwork for the sister city relationship, activities that are only now surfacing. I spoke with some of her colleagues in the International Solidarity Movement in Rafah, and I recorded one of the people, Will Hewitt, who's also from Olympia, who traveled to Gaza with Rachel. And I was wondering if you could play that now. This is a describing.
This is Will Hewitt, and I'm going to read an account from a local Palestinian man who's a friend of Rachel's and one of her favorite people in Rafah. She stayed at his house many times and just liked him a lot and said that his family was her family in Rafah. And I, myself, and Greg and Chris went over to his house and, you know, sat around in his porch with the laundry hanging from the line and talked to him. And, you know, right after we finished this conversation, we went out and built a fire out in front, and another tank drove by, and we asked him if we should go inside because it was dangerous, and he said, well, if they want to kill us, they'll kill us. And so we sat around the fire and talked for a while. But at first, he didn't really want to, like, give a report, and he just wanted to talk to us about Rachel because it's a mutual friend. But anyway, he finally said, I finally asked him if you could say anything to Rachel's family and friends in Olympia, what would you say? And He basically said, I'll just talk for a while, and you can write down whatever you want. So I tried to write down as accurately what he said as I could. But here it is. The first day when Rachel came to Rafah, Jenny and Joe tell me a new woman has come here. They say they want to put her in Block J. They say the first night in Block J, all the Israelis shoot at the tents, and she is very afraid. She did not smoke, and she started to smoke. At our first meeting, she did not know anything. She said she wanted to meet all the women and girls here. I took her to my uncle's house. Maybe she never met a Palestinian before. She is very, very happy. The first night when they slept at the water well, all the group went to Tel Sultan, but Rachel stayed here. All the group is in Tel Sultan. She is alone in Yibna. She lose telephone. She can't find her way because she is new. She call me. I don't know what is the problem. She is afraid. I tell her I know someone she can talk to. We sit here, all the group, me and my brother, and sit here talking and eating and laughing. You know, I'm sad, very sad. You know, before she died, she call me and say, I will see you soon. I stand here and wait, and I wait. I think maybe she is not coming this way. She is coming the other way. What time did she die? At maybe 5:15, Greg answers. You know, at 4:20 she called me. No, she was the same as people here. What the people here eat, she eats. Zaatar and olives. I don't know if you like this. She came to my mother, and my mother not speak English. Rachel not speak Arabic. But my mother understood. When the tank come to destroy the mosque here, she go and stand to stop the bulldozer to destroy the mosque. She loved this place. Hey, I can feel how the woman here feel. I say, if you want to know how the woman here feel, you can marry and stay here all your life. She all the time want to learn everything. I tell her, you take time. It is easy to know everything. When she come here, she brings something sweet in her bag for the children. They look in her bag and her pockets for something sweet. You know, this woman has come so far to this country to die. You know, to stop the bulldozers that destroy the houses. All the people thank this woman, and all the people are very, very sad. All the time, we don't forget this woman. She is a Palestinian woman, and she do all the Palestinian woman do. And that's all.
Right, thanks. And I also spoke with one of her other colleagues in Rafah, Greg Schnabel, and this is what he had to say. Rachel spent the last days of her life in Rafah with us. She didn't come here to die, but I know she loved it here. She cared for the people here. She didn't want to leave. She was always thinking of ways to stay here longer, to get more money, and to come back. Rachel was always joking. It was an integral part of her personality, and it made her feel at ease to be able to laugh as much as possible, living and working in a place like this. She was working on the Committee for the Liberation of Palestinian Witches, and I truly supported her proposal for our entire ISM budget to be spent on consulting Palestinian witches and casting of spells. The remainder of the budget was to be spent on glam rock costumes, to be worn in front of tanks while we sang Invincible and Love is a Battlefield by Pat Benatar. She had a special pink and white striped jumpsuit, which she saved for special actions. Everyone says that if she was wearing it last Sunday in front of the bulldozers, this never could have happened. She called me Simple Crick because my name means shovel in Arabic, and I drive a donkey cart. I still have a red lighter, which she returned to me last week after writing the words on it. Crick, a simple man who just wants his lighter back. Is that so much to ask? We used to always think of things to try and communicate with the soldiers, surprise them, make them laugh, make them recognize us and the Palestinians as humans. The last thing I heard her say to the soldiers and the bulldozer drivers via her megaphone last Sunday was, "What would your mothers think if they saw you doing this?" I hope their mothers whip them good. And that was Greg Schnabel. Much has been said about Rachel's final actions. They've been framed as two opposing forces, the bulldozer and Rachel. But there was a third factor, and it was the house that Rachel was protecting, the house of Dr. Samir Nasrallah of the Rafah Central Clinic and his family. Here is Dr. Samir in his own words. "We are Rachel's family in Rafah. She is a member of my family. She slept 15 times with us in our house. We ate together. She played with my daughters Reem and Iman and my son Karim. She was a special friend to my wife Itimod. She was very nice. She had strong personality and was very polite. I will never again see a power like hers when she faced the bulldozer outside my house. I was the only Palestinian who saw her action minute after minute. When I watched this, I became hysterical, shouting in front of my whole family, 'Rachel died, Rachel died.' Within 1 minute, I called the ambulance and then went to give her first aid. The ambulance came within 10 minutes and took her to the hospital. I went with Alice, Tom, and Joseph in the ambulance with Rachel to An-Najjar Hospital, where immediately 10 doctors did everything they could to save her. But sadly, I watched while her blood pressure dropped. My whole family cried so much because they said, We have lost our big sister. We lost so much when Rachel died, and we send condolences to you. I will make a memorial for Rachel in front of my house, and my street will be named after her. Yours sincerely, the Dr. Samir family. And now, with Rachel's death, those of us who knew her have found that she has become bigger than life. Now it is Rachel who is so big, so insurmountable, beyond reach even. She is beyond the realm of those of us who knew her. She belongs to the world community now, and it is important for those of us who knew her to accept that. In one of her letters from Rafa, she told us, "Please, Olympia, please watch Rafa. Please watch Rafa and talk about Rafa and continue to find your ways of changing things. This is what we pay for here, this strangulation and erasure of lives. The single most frequent request I hear over and over again is to be seen, to avoid falling victim to this violent and intentional forgetting. We all want our lives to mean something. These people are living next to death on a daily basis and telling me over and over again, this is not life." Now, my knowledge of Rafa is limited, as I've never been there before. I can see two armored bulldozers and a tank. I see eight internationals. I see Rachel standing up, facing a bulldozer with a megaphone. I see Rachel on the ground, being tended to by her friends. I see the house of Dr. Samir. I see the mock funeral procession. And I see the posters of Rachel on the wall of every building. And in 6 months, I see the completion of a new building in Rafa, a youth cultural center where the children of Rafa will have a library, a place to sing and dance, a place to use computers, to make art, to socialize, and to receive health care. The Union of Health... The Union of Health Work Committees in Gaza has already given this building a name. It is the Rachel Corey Cultural Center. This is just the beginning of the Olympia-Rafa sister city relationship. We will put Rafa on the map for the rest of the world to see. We are all a part of Rafa now. I hope to visit it one day, and I hope Rachel's family will do so as well. I know we will be welcomed. Thank you.
My name is Gina Patnaik, and on behalf of Rachel's extended family, I'd like to read to you a letter written by her cousin Emily, who's a foreign exchange student in Argentina. The girl that I remember is big cousin Rachel from my childhood, who collected Barbie dolls and taught me to play beauty pageant. When all the younger cousins gathered around, Rachel would draw 10 women's faces, and we would pick the prettiest one. Without fail, the blonde always won. Even back then, Rachel would get upset. "Come on, guys, get some originality." One time, she drew all the contestants with brown hair to liven things up a bit. Rachel was the oldest, and Gina copied her in everything, and I copied Gina in everything, and Sari copied me in everything, and Bridge, well, he was a boy, and what do boys know anyway? So in the end, we all did whatever Rachel did, which of course disgusted her. One time, she sat for 20 minutes without moving, trying to make us decide what game to play on our own. I passed those 20 minutes in a confused 5-year-old silence. I didn't know how to think without her and Gina leading the way. But it shows that even back then, at 10 years of age, Rachel was helping us break the mold. I guess the essence of a person never changes. In the aftermath of her death, I am trying to rationalize my feelings. But when I was talking to Cousin Sarah on the telephone, and she said, "I need a Cheryl hug," I knew exactly what she meant. And in Rachel's emails, when she writes about Grandma and Uncle Craig, that is my grandma and my Uncle Craig she's talking about. There's something in family that binds you unlike any other tie. I might not know who her last boyfriend was or what kind of music she liked, but I know Rachel because I know myself. I'm proud that the blood which ran through her veins is the same blood which runs through ours.
I'm Elizabeth Corey. I'm also a cousin of Rachel. I'm going to read a message from one of the many international siblings that Rachel had through the generosity of Craig and Cindy Corey, which included Kazuyo of Japan, Anyuta of Russia, Saiko of Japan, and finally Gustavo of Brasilia. And this is a message from Gustavo from Brasilia. About 10 years ago, Rachel welcomed me at her home in the United States. She became not only my host sister, but my little sister. A young and caring Rachel helped me with my poor English and, together with her family, unconsciously introduced me to her non-superficial American values, already genuinely based on the defense of cultural diversity, the respect for divergence, and the need of active engagement. During all these years of constant intellectual growth and healthy exchange of opinions, Rachel's courage and determination in standing up for her ideals became obvious. From Gaza, she wrote telling me about a refugee camp she spent time at called Brazil, saying, "When I go to Brazil at night, I think of you and look forward to coming to see you." Concerned with the greatest human cause, which is saving lives despite national, racial, religious, and other identity elements, she became a global peacemaker, a true citizen of the world. Rachel, wherever you are, we admire your work and will always love you. Beijos, Gustavo Ramos from Brazil.
I am Charlene Helpley Pierce, eldest of the cousins on Rachel's father's side, while Rachel was the baby of the group. I'm here to read the words of Doris Corey, Graham to Rachel and I. I hope I do them justice. My Rachel, a grandmother's view. When Rachel was 2 years old, Craig carried her in his arms up to the top of a hill in their picnic spot, and she said, "This is the wide world, and I'm going to it." And so she did. Rachel, in her short life, embraced the whole wide world. Her person-to-person relatedness was remarkable. Rachel's life didn't touch yours lightly. You felt and cherished the impact. Rachel, always creative and focused, met life from various angles. Poetry, drama, song, dance, environmental concerns, and arrived at social justice. She had the courage, the strength, the conviction that one person could make a difference. She acted on it. Rachel, my lovely, loving, joyous granddaughter, lived a short life, but gave each day all that she had. I am proud to be Rachel's Graham.
Hi. I'm Chris Corey, Rachel's brother, and this is my sister, Sarah Corey. Unfortunately, Sarah this week has lost her voice. Most of my family's probably been waiting a lifetime for me to lose my voice, but no such luck today, sorry. So you'll have to bear with me. And it's been tremendous for me today to hear from so many people who knew Rachel later in her life. What Sarah and I are going to talk about are our memories, and because we were her older siblings, myself 7 years older, Sarah 5.5 years older than Rachel. We have a lot of early memories of Rachel. Our memories of Rachel begin on the day that she was born. We'd both stayed at our friends' houses the night before, and we were picked up early from school that day by my father to go bring our new baby sister home. We drove to the hospital where Sarah and I waited in the lobby for what I swear to this day was 4, 5, 6 hours. although my parents say it was only a matter of minutes, while my father went to retrieve Rachel and my mother. As we left the hospital, Sarah and I sat in the back seat of the car while my mother sat in the front, holding our baby sister in her arms. As we drove from the hospital heading home to bring Rachel into our lives, my mother turned around to see Sarah and I in the back seat of the car with tears streaming down our faces. At the time, and for me, ever since, we swore the tears were in response to the cruel abandonment in the waiting room of St. Peter's Hospital. But in retrospect, I think they were in realization that our lives were now forever changed and that Rachel was a part of them. Rachel was always a keen observer of people. And some of those earliest observations, often unfortunately, were directed at our family. We remember when Rachel was less than 2 years old and my mother, always a slave to fashion, as Rachel was, I'm sure you know, decided that it was time to update her look for the early 80s. Later that day, my father packed the family into the car, telling Rachel, who was particularly anxious to see Mom, that we were going to pick her up at the salon. As my mother sat in the car, now coiffed in what can best be described, pick your favorite pop culture reference, as either a Clarabelle the Clown or Mike Brady-esque perm, Sarah and I, probably coached by my father, managed to keep straight faces at her new look. Rachel, however, immediately broke into tears. She was terrified of this stranger and wondering what had become of her mother. As my mother reached over, spoke to her to console her, Rachel, for the first time, recognized the voice behind the hair, and instantly, her tears were replaced by giggles as she spent the rest of the ride home pointing and laughing at my mother's new look. We have many memories of my sister, her constant companions, Ebony the cat and Brownie the chicken, her favorite stuffed animal, Dusty the bear. The car trips to the Midwest to visit our family, one where Sarah and Rachel caught up singing to the radio with the windows rolled down rather than watching the highway signs. Ended up in Minnesota rather than Iowa, several hundred miles off course. Many of my memories of Rachel are from her youth as I went off to college when she was only 11. However, I remember receiving her letters and her drawings when I was at school. She was just as eloquent and observant as you've heard today as a teenager as she was at 23. Sarah shared time with Rachel more recently. Rachel moved in with Sarah 4 months ago in order to save money for her trip to Rafa. This gave them time to do the things that sisters do, talking about boyfriends and husbands, debating politics, and watching TV. Buffy the Vampire Slayer was apparently one of her favorites. Sorry, Rachel, but the cat's out of the bag now. It's clear to anyone who knows us that my parents raised three very different children, each with their own personalities, their own politics, and their own beliefs. Rachel was the poet and the dreamer, the compassionate one, the one that gave us hugs. Even though we were different, Rachel brought us closer together with a soft touch and a listening ear, and opened our eyes to her world and awed us with her dedication to improving it. We will miss her touch, we'll miss her voice, and we will especially miss those hugs.
Oh, wow. I so needed this. What a week. What I was remembering when we've gone through this week and giving press conferences, you know, like we do that every day. I'm sorry, I have prepared remarks, but I just can't get to them. So, because lately, just recently, Rachel wrote me, I think actually wrote Cindy, tell Dad to do something. What's the word I'm looking for? I'm sorry.
I don't know.
I'm sorry. Radical, right. Do something radical, right.
And I told, after a press conference, I told a, one of the writers there, you know, I could just hear her sitting on my shoulder or something saying, "Way to go, Poppy!" And this same guy asked me, "What do you mean when you say community?" And I think we got to work here. People shouldn't have to ask that, you know, because we know here in Olympia. I think they know in Arafa. I've been hearing about it from around the world. They know. And also, during this week, when we've been talking and dwelling in just terrible detail about Rachel's last 30 minutes of her life, I found it real therapeutic to think about the first 30 minutes of her life and the wondrous moment when I first met Rachel. And maybe it'll help you if you can just think of the first time you met Rachel. It's a happy thought. But that's not what I came here to talk about. I was supposed to say something funny. People that didn't know Rachel asked us for examples of Rachel's early activism, or what she was like when she was little. And sort of embarrassingly, at the time, I couldn't think of anything. And then later, we'd start laughing, thinking of anecdotes, things that went on. So I'd like to share two of those anecdotes with you now that Cindy and I were laughing about this morning. And one was back in seventh grade. Now Cindy was back in Iowa caring for her ill father, and I had to go away on a business trip. So I was going to leave Rachel with her big sister, Sarah. And the theory there is that Sarah's old enough to care for Rachel, and I was hoping Rachel was young enough to tell on Sarah. But anyhow, right before I'm going to go, we're standing in the kitchen, and Rachel is telling me about the walkout sympathy strike that she's going to lead the next day at Jefferson School. I said, "What strike?" "Well, the teachers are striking across the state, but they're actually not striking locally, so she's still supposed to go to school. So the students thought that they'd have a walkout, a sympathy walkout, and then they'd, you know, talk about the issues of funding for schools and teachers." And so I'm saying, "I'm not going to be here. You get in trouble at school, I won't be here. You can't do it." She says, "I got to do it." I said, "You can't do it. I got to do it. You can't do it. I got to do it. Why do you have to do it?" "Because I'm the one that called the press." So, okay. What do you do? So I said, "I got to call your principal." And she can't call the principal. Can't let him. So anyway, I call the principal, Kevin Eboy. And I said, "Kevin, this is Craig Corey." "Yeah." I said, "Yeah, I got this person in my house that would prefer to remain nameless. And she's talking about a sympathy walkout of the students in sympathy of the teacher strike." I said, "What do you know about it?" He says, "I don't know much about it." I said, "Well, what do you plan to do?" And he said, "Well, I was thinking fire hoses and dogs." I thought, "Okay, well, that sounds good to me." Anyway, we talked, and he said, "Well, what she says, you know, I didn't really want her to go there, but she said she had to go because she was the one that called the press." And he says, "She's the one that did what?" I said, "Yeah, she's the one that called the press. She just called down there. She had to call three times and ask for the city desk. And she got through, and she read a little speech. I read it, and I read it to Kevin. And he says, "They're likely to come." So anyway, there's kind of a go-between because, of course, Rachel couldn't be seen as telling on all this stuff. So we got the message across and sort of things arranged that there'd be a half hour and the students could go out to the side of the school. And then I left on the airplane, and I talked to her about it a couple of weeks later. It's so typical of activism. I said, "How'd it go? How'd it go while you went out there and talked to the students and everything?" And she said, "Well, I just stood there and talked for a while, but all the boys just tried to look up my dress." So I left, went back in the school, and acted like I didn't know what was going on. Then another thing we were talking about, another incident. Cindy's been a great volunteer in around the school district here, and one of the things she volunteered to do was work on a writing assessment program for the high school. And actually, it was a district-wide program, but it was used at high school. And when Rachel was a junior, I believe, in high school, they were taking a writing assessment. And as you all know, we've all heard, writing is very personal for Rachel. So you have this piece of paper, and you have five topics to write on. You're supposed to write, I don't know, you know, the people out here that know how you're supposed to do this, five paragraphs or something like that. And there's a box on the upper right-hand corner of this piece of paper to keep the score in. And there are going to be three scores. They don't, you know, they won't know who's writing, but they'll score this thing and on different aspects, and they'll write the score up there in the right-hand corner. And the students have three different hour periods of English, you know, on three different days to write in here. And, you know, Rachel's a good writer, so we think piece of cake. Okay, these five topics. But words are too precious to Rachel to waste or have somebody else do. So for Rachel, it was like being mugged or something, that somebody would try to steal words and tell her what to write. So first day goes by, and I'd like to think she was working on her math or something at least, but I doubt it. She was just probably writing on another piece of paper, knowing Rachel. Nothing. She's going to do it. So we talk to her, you know, and say, you can do this, you know. You just go do it. It's not a big deal. Just go ahead. You know, you got to play along with the system sometime. Second day, no deal. Nothing. Nada. And so now, you know, we're thinking, this kid is not going to do the writing assessment. She's not going to graduate from high school. She won't go to college. How can she be a success? You know, what's going to happen to our daughter? So we try to give her a pep talk. But, you know, she's not going with it. Anyway, she went back on third day. She did write. And generally, you wouldn't know what was written by your daughter. But since Cindy was part of the program, she was part of, I think, screening these things.
Carl, because we had discussed this in the assessment when we were talking about different types of assessment, and he knew that I had some problems with those assessments, too. And so he came and one day, and he stopped me and he said, look at this. And she had written an essay, but I think she got high scores on all of it the way she did it. And I if I remember right, they took it to the school board to show it as one of the examples of what kids do. But Craig, you can give the punchline.
Anyway, thank you, dear. Just never give up the stage to your wife, you know. Anyway, her first line was, you can't put me in a box.
Rachel wasn't a purse person. Some of you maybe recognize this tin that she used to carry. First, though, I feel so good. I'm just so happy to be back in Olympia. Thank you very much. This has been great for us. And I'm going to read because it's just a day when I need to read. Rachel gave me long, loving hugs. When we were apart for a time and then reunited, we would hold each other for a very long time. When I've struggled most this week, I've stopped and waited for those long, loving hugs, and I can still feel her embrace. And this isn't written, but I did that this morning, and I'm just training myself so that I can do that forever. For all of you who I know loved her in many different ways, I hope that you will carry her with you as you continue your journeys in this needy world, and that you will allow her spirit of love, peace, and justice to embrace you. When I was feeling a little frustrated with my efforts to protest the war with Iraq, Rachel wrote me an email from Rafa with a long bit of encouragement. She told me that she thought I was very strong and that she thought she had learned persistence from me. Rachel nurtured me as much as I nurtured her, we nurtured each other. I ask all of you to nurture this moment, to seize this moment, to honor Rachel's life and death by doing whatever it is you can do to join with the good people of Palestine and the good people of Israel who want to change the course of this conflict. I think Colin and Stefan have told you that she had planned to stay in Rafah until June, and she wrote me, her original plan had been to come back late April, and in the last email, actually one that went to her papi, she laid out her plans, and she said she decided to stay there in June partially because she had watched another person from ISM say goodbye, and she saw how difficult that was going to be to say goodbye to the children and the people that she had grown to know and care for. I want to share a quote. Again, it's from my niece who can't be here because she's in Argentina, and I think maybe she said this talking to one of her aunts when she called. Rachel found something she really believed in. She was passionate about what she was doing. Some people go through life never finding their passion. Rachel had found hers. How many of us can say that? Rachel changed our lives beautifully and irrevocably, first when she was born, and now, nearly 24 years later, she's done that once again in her departure. I know you understand how deeply we wish she had more time, but typical of Rachel, I think, she left us with so much to think about and so much to do. Thank you.
As we come to the closing of a wonderfully powerful experience together, I want to share some information with you all. There is a display of Rachel's work in the first floor of the library building, and you're welcome to visit that area. Those of you that would like to offer personal condolences to the family, you're invited to come to the back of the bay here. Ushers will help you find the direction back here at the end of the program. Also, the family has asked and encouraged that all of you to take a look at the posters that identify the children that have died in Israel and in the occupied territories. Those of you that would like to write a note of condolence or remembrance to the Corys may do so on one of the several tables we've left in the gym. Secure boxes are also there for you if you would like to leave a donation to the charities the family has suggested. Now we will play a short video, The State of Words of the World's Children, made while Rachel was in the fifth grade at Lincoln Elementary School in the Options Program.
You're listening to KAOS 89.3 FM.
I'm here for other children. I'm here because I care. I'm here because children everywhere are suffering and because 40,000 people die each day from hunger. I'm here because those people are mostly children. We have got to understand that the poor are all around us and we're ignoring them. We have got to understand that these deaths are preventable. We have got to understand that people in third world countries think and care and smile and cry just like us. We have got to understand that they dream our dreams and we dream theirs. We have got to understand that they are us. We are them. My dream is to stop hunger by the year 2000. My dream is to give the poor a chance. My dream is to save the 40,000 people who die each day. My dream can and will come true if we all look into the future and see the light that shines there. If we ignore hunger, that light will go out. If we all help and work together, it will grow and burn free with the potential of tomorrow.
Please join me in a moment of silence for Rachel. Thank you all so very much. Let's all go and do good in the world.